Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Perdita!
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you are listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate the support. If you like the show, you can rate it. You can share it with your friends. We do appreciate that. The website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. On Twitter, you can find me at Macroaggressions. On Instagram, at Macroaggressions Podcast. Thank you to our amazing sponsors that help us to make this show work. I'm telling you right now, if you need legal help, there is a company out there called Legal Shield that is your solution. I promise you this. Just go to the website, don'tgetpushedaround.com, and take a look for yourself. Legal Shield's been doing this for half a century. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They're available in Canada and the United States. And it gets you access to a high-powered attorney, a law firm in your area that can take care of all sorts of things for you. Paperwork, last will and testament, medical power of attorney, financial power of attorney. If you have some stuff you want to set up, you want to, some documentation that you need for your kids. If work wants you, you know, whatever you can dream of that a lawyer can help you with, you've got access to it now. For $30 a month, it's a dollar a day. It's very, very reasonable to have this sort of, think of it like an insurance policy, you know? Not to mention, you're going to get, if you knock out all those documents that would rightly cost you thousands of dollars for you and your spouse, knock them out in the first month, this service will have paid for itself for the next 10 years. You know, I mean, it is very reasonable. So I'll tell you what, work wants you to sign some sort of weird new contract that includes some sort of language about medical injections, and you're not really sure about it, and you're not sure what your rights are about this, send it to your attorney. You got a speeding ticket, you got a traffic, one of those red light camera tickets, you got a whatever, send it to your attorney. They fight this stuff all the time. They know exactly how to do it. Somebody's jerking you around at some store. They, you know, you bought something from them. It broke, you know, the next week. You took it back. They say, sorry, we can't do anything. Well, I'll tell you what, things start to change when they get a letter from your attorney that knows exactly what to say, right? So again, I don't want us to use this powers for evil, all right? Use this only to defend yourself, to protect yourself. So if you are so inclined and you think this might be something that you or your family members would be interested in, just go to the website, read up about it, see what you think. www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. They'll help you out. Also, thanks to Chemical Free Body. They are making the best vitamins out there. They really are. I can attest to this. It's now been I think 3 years. No, 3 years. The show has been around for 3 years. Chemical Free Body came on just about the same time the show launched. So I'm on it. I'm on it every day. Green 85. I drink it every single day. No, I'm not kidding. I buy it by the six packs of it. So it'll last me 6 months. But if you're inclined, if you think that, like, I don't know, nobody's coming to save you with regard to your health and you're going to have to do it on your own, you're going to have to be responsible for it. Well, at least get products that work. All right. Can we acknowledge that that's a good place to start? Go to chemicalfreebody.com and just go shopping. If you find something you like, use the promo code macro. That'll save you a bunch of money. They've got free shipping. They've got all kinds of products. But Pat Miletich has got a new product out with them called Super Soldier. I haven't tried that one yet, but I love Tim's stuff. So I'll eventually probably pick some up because I'm down for all that stuff. I did do the detox in a box. I highly recommend that. That actually kind of scared me. It was too efficient. It cleaned me out. Like, I lost so much weight that I had to go buy new shorts and everything. Like, I was not expecting that. I was expecting a cleanse. I was not expecting to have it be like a weight loss component. Look, some results may vary. I'm not saying that you're going to have the same results that I had, but that detox bundle did a number on me. So chemicalfreebody.com is the website. The promo code is macro. That will get you some savings. And you know what? We'll take it. We'll take it. And thanks to Tim and the crew over there for making good products, which in turn make my job a lot easier because I don't have a problem recommending them. Well, I wanted to get into this family for a while. The Huxley family. We all have heard of Aldous Huxley. I mean, I think most of us have. But I tell you, he might be the least interesting of all of them. Really, this is a family tree that is, you know, just much like these other British aristocracy families from the 1800s that were very powerful and influential. There's a common theme running through all of them. It ain't good either. They belong to these secret societies, and they want the world to look a certain way. You have to also take into consideration the fact that while they're involved in this mid to late 1800s, early 1900s, the British Empire was really dominating. And so they were on the winning team. You know, they were the New England Patriots, you know, making the playoffs every year and winning a bunch of Super Bowls for a long period of time. And everybody was either wanted to work with them or was terrified of getting overrun by them. And so the ideas that came out of this era were rooted in, you know, the thought process of the time, which is the white man is superior and we're going to colonize all these savages in faraway lands. We're going to introduce them to the rule of law, probably trade them on the slave market, definitely steal all their resources, 100% murder as many of them as we can. You know, so there's this really, really messed up thought process that's happening. And so it's not limited to the Huxleys. It's not limited to the Rothschilds, but it is of a sort of similar thought process, which is we're superior, as evidenced by the fact that we're taking over the world. Our ideas are better, our technology's better, our skin color is better, you know, all the things that people do, you know, when they're high on their own intellectual capacity. You know, they just really thought they were the pinnacle of society. But you know, their ideas were drenched in blood. You know, I mean, if it were up to these guys, it would just, the streets would flow with the blood of the non-believers. You know, it just would be a mess. And the Huxley family, you know, their bloodthirsty tendencies were sort of disguised by the fact that it was all science. You know, they kind of hid behind the science. And it's like, well, I'm not saying that we should go kill all the poors. The science says it. You know, I'm just telling you what the science says. I'm just telling you what Darwin says. I'm just telling you what, I mean, I clearly these people came from apes, right? These subhumans in Africa are related to apes. I mean, this is their line of thinking. So we're going to get into not just Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World, which I think most people recognize. And I'm not trying to let him off the hook. He was out of his fucking mind too. But his brother, Julian Huxley, and his grandfather, Thomas Henry Huxley, known as Darwin's Bulldog. Well, I got news for you. These people were up to no good, and we're going to talk about it. What do you think of that? So the family tree of the Huxleys, if we could put it this way, has its roots in the dark world of Royal Society eugenics, really disguised as scientific advancement and study. You know, it's eugenics, meaning the thinning of the herd, the trimming of the, you know, the pruning of the rose bushes. It's mass murder, but we're going to hide it behind scientific advancement so that it sounds prestigious. When in actuality, when you dig into what it is, it goes back to this whole ideology that all these maniacs have: depopulation, the poor are taking up too much space on our planet, they're breeding too quickly, we don't like the color of their skin, we'll enslave them and use them as much as we can, but for all the riffraff, they've got to go, and they definitely need to stop having so many babies, you know. So this is just, you know, and again, I'm certainly not going to let these people off the hook because their ideology is psychotic, but it was also sort of normalized back then. You know, it was, and if you were living in London in the late 1800s and you were a wealthy person and you were an educated person, this is how you thought. This is how a lot of people thought. But that's by no means a get out of jail free card on this. So the science led to writing, and the writing led to science fiction. As we move down the family tree of the Huxleys, and you wind up into all of them wrote, even, you know, the Aldous and Julian's father was a writer as well. He wasn't well known, and he didn't have the sort of connections that his, you know, that Thomas Henry Huxley had. But they all were writers, and they were all educated, and they're all very smart, and they all had mental illness. It was a running theme through this family. They were all out of their minds in a very scientific sense, not like the way I kind of throw that term around. I mean, they were all in and out of mental institutions, you know. So there's that. You know, there is that component too. Everyone's like, oh, they're so smart, they're so educated, and they yes, and also certifiably nuts. So we're going to get into some of that. They focused on this concepts such as the evolution of man. They were very involved in ethics. They were involved in eugenics. They were involved in selective breeding. They were deeply interested in scientific control and depopulation. These were the core tenets of the Huxley family. They were interested in a very sciencey family, very well-read, very well-educated, I guess. Thomas Henry Huxley was self-taught. We're going to get to him in a second, but the majority of the family, they were smart. They liked science, and they liked writing about science. And then as it got on, they liked writing about science in a way that might have been fictional and might have also been sort of predictive programming. Yeah, if you look at Brave New World and you think of it as a science fiction book, it's a crazy science fiction book. If you look at it as predictive programming and laying the foundation for where these lunatics want to take us, it takes on a much different meaning. And we're gonna wrap with all this, but you know, and listen, they all openly pushed for a new world order, again with the same terms, the same terminology. So let's stop with Alex Jones created the term New World Order because he's a crazy conspiracy theorist. He did not. This term has been around for 100 years before Alex Jones was even born. And these guys love to use it. So let's talk first about Thomas Henry Huxley. He was born in 1825, died in 1895. That's a pretty good run for, you know, 70 years back then. I mean, you could get eaten by a bear relatively easily. Maybe not in London. I don't know. Possibly. This was the guy whose nickname was Darwin's Bulldog. And Darwin, as you know, Charles Darwin, wrote a book called On the Origin of Species. That was a book that was scientific in nature, but it had a theme running through it of, well, it was about evolution. But it also got into this weird area of evolution where it's, you know, it's talking about the strong, only the strongest survive. And of course, they're coming from a place of, we're the strongest. See, we're the dominant species here. If only everybody could evolve and become just like us, old white British men, then they would see that we're the dominant species. So it's science, but it's also kind of dogma as well. So Thomas Henry Huxley, this is the grandfather of Aldous and Julian Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, as they say, was a biologist and anthropologist who specialized in a science called comparative anatomy. And he was one of the main pushers of Darwin's theory. In fact, Charles Darwin himself was like an old man who wasn't really very comfortable talking about this stuff and out in public a ton. So Huxley, Thomas Huxley, was like his PR guy. It was like his hype man. You know, he would go out and have the debates on behalf of Charles Darwin. You know, and they were close. They didn't agree on everything, but they were very close in their ideology. And Thomas Huxley liked to debate, felt very strongly about Darwin's theories on this, and also, you know, listen, this aligns with their ideology of, you know, you're just gonna, you know, all you dumb people out there are gonna wind up in an evolutionary cul-de-sac where nothing ever becomes of you because you're not great like us. So there's this superiority complex concept that runs through it as well. But like I said, Thomas Huxley was self-taught, no formal schooling. Autodidact, I think, is what they call that when you become an expert on something, but you're not, you sort of figure it out on your own. It's an impressive feat for sure. But again, I'm not saying that everything that he proposed was anchored in science. You know, I think a lot of it is ideology too. So, and look, it's worth being suspicious of the theory because the wrong people were promoting it. You know, all the people associated with the crown were deeply involved in this, and they're of course trying to justify their colonizing of the world. You know, there were people out there saying, God, this is really kind of a bad look for you guys. You're out there conquering Africa and India and Indonesia and places like this, and you're enslaving these people. And so in order to kind of justify that savagery, what this offered the royal family and the members of the elite society of Britain back in the mid to late 1800s, it offered them sort of a, well, look, the science says we're the chosen ones, you know? So it kind of gives them it's like, I know we're chosen, but don't get mad at me. Look, it's the science, you know, trust the science. So the Anthony Faucis of their era were out there, you know, saying we can't help ourselves. It's scientifically proven. The science has been settled. We're superior, you know? And then they go about sort of justifying that by trying to find components of science that back up this insane ideology that they have. But I'll tell you what, most people don't know who Thomas Huxley is, but if you've ever heard that birds evolved from small carnivorous dinosaurs, have you heard that theory that's how birds came? Well, that's Thomas Huxley. That's 100% him. And it is still it's still taught to this day that somewhere Corey Good is out there just going, the blue chickens evolved from carnivorous dinosaurs. Oh, don't sue me, Corey, you piece of shit. So Thomas Huxley was a member of the Council of the Royal Society. He was later a professor of natural history at the Royal School of Mines and Mines, M-I-N-E-S, not mimes. That would be funny. As well as being a professor at the Royal Institution. So connected, right? I think that's Royal Council of the Royal Society. Check. Professor at the Royal Institution. Check. Professor at the Royal School of Mines. Check. You know, I mean, so he's deep state. He's British deep state. Maybe not royalty himself, but royalty adjacent. And definitely creating the justification for these people to continue a philosophy of colonization and domination. He started something called the X Club. And this was used to advance the cause of science. He did this with 8 other members. All of them were fellow of the Royal Societies, you know, fellows of that, and all fans of Darwin. And if you want more information on anything X related, X Club or whatnot, I got to send you over to Daniel List at Dark Journalist, because he's got 130 plus episodes on X steganography, just that concept. And when you dig back in, anything that's got X attached to it, it's worth looking at. And X Club is no different. It's a bunch of scientists, nerds getting together and talking about how great Darwin was and how they're all connected to the royals. And they were writing a lot during this time. They came up with a concept, the idea of survival of the fittest. That term, survival of the fittest, that came out of the X Club. That's where we get that. This is what they say. This group was a devotion to science, pure and free, untrammeled by religious dogmas. So they're all atheists. They're not dragging the church into this. They've replaced the church with science, the church of science, I guess. And so that's how they're looking at it at this time. And this collection of people were not just meeting. They did this from the 1860s to the 1880s. They were governing the scientific affairs of Britain from the 1860s to the 1880s. That's a really important time too, because that's when a lot of the scientific ideas were being normalized and mainstreamed and put out, like evolution, right? And you know, there's a lot of creationists out there, a lot of people. I think most people before that were like, God created us, right? And I'm not going to turn this into a debate one way or the other, but just the idea of evolution, that's Darwin's. It's Darwin's theory of evolution. It's pretty flimsy. I mean, there's some aspects of it that you look at and you go, oh, I get it. It seems like there's a progression, sort of a evolution component to it. But then there are some big flaws in the thinking. And then when you add in the fact that their ideology was, they were trying to work backwards and justify their poor behavior by saying, well, it's just the science, you know? So it's not as rock solid as you think, but if you had control over the information of science from the 1860s to the 1880s in Britain, you were really kind of driving the information bus on this whole thing. And they wrote for Nature magazine, which is a eugenics magazine. You could still find Nature magazine out there. And you're like, oh, it's going to be about butterflies and everything? Sort of. I mean, when they're not soft selling depopulation as an option too, but that's because it's a eugenics magazine disguised as a Nature magazine. But Thomas Huxley was a racist, like most of the British elite Royal Society. It was very common back then. I'm not trying to excuse it, but it was very normalized. And the concept of higher and lower races is found basically throughout Thomas Huxley's work. I mean, it's just like, he's just a hierarchy of who's in charge, who should be in charge, and then they start to get into some real weird scientific, you know, measuring skulls and things like that. So I'm going to read a quote from Thomas Huxley, just in case you weren't sure. Okay, quote: "It may be quite true that some Negroes are better than some white men, but no rational man, cognizant of the facts, believes that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior, of the average white man." So, in case there was any question, in case there was any question, we'll just put that to rest. The Huxleys were deeply racist. But again, it was a theme running back then. So, but here's a concept that Huxley came up with that is super racist. Okay. I mean, really bad, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Huxley went on to, postulate that the white man is less related to the black man than the black man is related to apes. Like this dude, Thomas Huxley, was not a fan of the black people, not a fan. But this is, you know, what this is called is scientific racism. And whenever you put the science in front of it, for some reason, it gives it a little bit more prestige. It sounds a little bit more reasonable, but it's scientific racism and it's the precursor to eugenics all the time. And because it's science, it seeks to scientifically justify racism so that eugenics programs like sterilization and depopulation can have not just the moral ground to operate, but in some cases also the legal ground to operate. So it's one thing, you know, when you're trying to make this, when you're trying to normalize it and eventually legalize it, it really helps if you can say, it's not my idea, it's the science. You know, I'm not saying that black people are more related to monkeys than they are to white people. The science is saying it. So it gives them okay. Well, if it's the science, then yes, of course we will enact laws in America that allow sterilization. You know, we will, you know, allow that to happen in America for decades. I mean, again, I mentioned this in a previous episode. But everyone thinks that the Nazis came up with this sterilization and eugenics program, that they like dreamed it up, you know, while taking that Percocet, right? The Nazi meth that they had, right? That they were all just sitting around getting high, saying, you know, oh, well, we'll come up with this idea we'll sterilize all of these people and then maybe even we'll murder them. The sterilization program that the Nazis got was borrowed from America. Margaret Sanger taught him about that. They used the legalization of it in America as the justification to legalize it in Germany. So again, we're backwards on that one. We in America think, oh, the Nazis are terrible. They did all the sterilization and eugenics programs. Well, yes, they did all that, and that's terrible. Who do you think they got the idea from? Oh, well, they got it from Adolf Hitler. No. They got it from Margaret Sanger, and Margaret Sanger got it from all of these people in the British Roundtable. She got it from the Huxleys. This is how they were all talking about it. So, but Thomas Huxley wasn't just a biologist. He was what was known as a comparative anatomist, right? So he would take a look at skeletons and bones and sort of compare them one to another. He examined animal species, he examined humans, he sort of did it all. But this is where he got into like the measuring skulls and measuring noses. And that's, you know, kind of like a pseudoscience, right? But the Nazis used that as the justification. If you've ever heard the stories, I don't know if you've ever watched enough World War II documentaries. God knows I think I might have watched them all at least three times. There's a portion of the Nazis, the run-up to all this, where they start to get very interested in racial purity. And one of the components is measuring skulls. Right. So like, if it's kind of like a buzz, like a joke now, an inside joke, like, oh shit, are we at the point where we're measuring skulls? Cause what that means is you're one step away from rounding people up based on the size of their heads and putting them in camps. So again, the idea for that from the Nazis came from Thomas Huxley. So he's the guy out there measuring skulls, measuring noses, saying, oh, your nose is a little too long. Maybe you believe in this religion, and off to the gas chambers you go. So all of this stuff was really predicated on the Huxley's work. Okay. So I'm not, once again, I feel like I have to do this song and dance. I'm not trying to absolve the Nazis from their ideology. I'm just saying that it wasn't them that came up with the ideas. They put them in place and did a lot of bad shit with it for sure. But they weren't brainstorming this. This was building off of existing science, and the existing science was coming to play because of Thomas Huxley. So, and his idea, his comparative, you know, comparing bones and comparing skull sizes and things like this. They call it racial hierarchy of intelligence. That's kind of the term for it. And really what he sought to do was group people into primitive and civilized, you know. Guess who got put in what, you know? So, I mentioned the mental illness. It's not insignificant in the Huxley family. It's it actually wound up becoming quite a big deal. It put Julian Huxley. Well, let's get into Julian Huxley, shall we? He's Thomas Henry Huxley's grandson. So, Sir Julian Huxley, born 1887, died 1975. Evolutionary biologist, eugenicist, and globalist. Very well-known globalist. So I know Aldous Huxley gets all the play, but you're going to find out things about Julian Huxley, which will make you go, oh, he's the real bad guy in the family. And I assure you he is. I mean, his grandfather set him down on this course, but Julian took the ball and ran with it. So he had multiple, since I mentioned mental illness, he had multiple nervous breakdowns during his lifetime. Okay. It that required hospitalization, not just he's having a bad day or his girlfriend dumped him, but like they put him in the nut house, right? And on one occasion, his brother was in the nut house with him, not Aldous, but a different brother named Trevenin. Was hospitalized with depression at the same time that Julian was in the same mental institution, and his brother killed himself, right? So it was really bad. I think they later sort of diagnosed them. I don't know if they have given the official diagnosis or it was sort of like a hella diagnosis, but they described them as both, you know, as the family having being bipolar and just having manic depression where they just went off the deep end. And so it was a theme that ran through his entire life. And you know, it makes you wonder, like, are you depressed because you have these ideas about murdering large percentages of the world? Or do you have these murderous thoughts because you're just mentally ill? I don't know. But I do know that this guy was part of the creation of UNESCO, United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And he became the first director general of UNESCO in 1946. Again, connected to the United Nations. When I mentioned that he's a globalist, you know, the United Nations shouldn't be much of a surprise. He co-founded the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, the original. Okay, brother. Not that one. The other one. The one that deals with animals. The World Wildlife. He founded it in 1961 on September 11th. But maybe that was just a gigantic coincidence. I don't know. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. But with the stated goal to reduce humans' impact on the environment by murdering them. Just kidding. But not really. Just kidding. I mean, that is. What the World Wildlife Fund, I mentioned this before, Maurice Strong, Prince Philip, Julian Huxley. Those are the guys that developed the whole thing, you know, and it's got the panda bear and you can raise money and, oh, don't you want to give money to this organization? Don't give money to that organization. Don't give money to the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund. Not to be confused with the Wrestling Federation that had to change its name. Julian Huxley wrote books with H.G. Wells, who was also a depopulation enthusiast and psychopath, and worked in the fields of evolution, genetics, and anthropology, while all the time pushing for depopulation through eugenics. Now, so again, when you start talking, when you get into the fields of evolution and genetics and anthropology, you are very close to an area that gets you into what is known as eugenics, which is depopulation. It's just improving the stock of everybody, you know. And of course, they'll talk about it in terms of animals, thinning the herd of animals, you know, get rid of the weak ones so that the stronger ones have more of an opportunity to thrive, and so that they don't have to waste their time looking after the weak ones. And you go, oh, well, if we can use this with sheep, can we use this with people? The answer is you're not supposed to, but of course they are. They do that, and they are deeply involved in eugenics, always have been. He pushed for, he was pushing for the acceptance of the concept of natural selection as the primary agent of evolution. So the concept of natural selection, how he described it, was natural selection plus time equals biological improvement. So on a long enough timeline, if you've got smarter lizards or lizards that develop certain types of spotting that make them blend in with their surroundings a little bit better than the previous version, those traits tend to get passed on because they tend to live a little bit longer because they're not getting eaten. And therefore, if you have natural selection, meaning nature just picked you to be better, plus enough time, there will be biological improvement. So what these guys wanted to do, and Julian Huxley won the Darwin Medal of the Royal Society, you know, of course, not a surprise, but what these guys wanted to do was really, instead of natural selection, it was unnatural selection. It was selection by them. And as far as time, so unnatural selection plus time equals biological improvement, the time is now. You've all got to go. So unnatural selection plus time, we don't have any more time, equals biological improvement that they dictate. So they want to speed up nature. They're looking at this as scientists going, this is how it works in nature over the course of millions of years, maybe even billions of years, who knows. But we don't have that much time. We need to take care of this problem now. So we're going to do the selecting, and we're going to manage the time, and then we're going to get biological improvements. Don't you know? Isn't that, that's how they thought. So let me, I'm going to read a quote from Julian Huxley. This is 1941. So the war is going on. I don't know. It doesn't really matter all that much in the context of this, but just so you know, this is what he said. If so, then we must plan our eugenic policy along some such lines as the following. The lowest strata, allegedly less well endowed genetically, are reproducing relatively too fast. Therefore, birth control methods must be taught them. They must not have too easy access to relief or hospital treatment, lest the removal of the last check on natural selection should make it too easy for children to be produced or to survive. Long unemployment should be grounds for sterilization, or at least relief should be contingent upon no further children being brought into the world, and so on. That is to say, much of our eugenic program will be curative and remedial merely, instead of preventive and constructive. This is scientific racism. That's what it is. Just straight up. You know, when you're talking about, you don't want to remove that last check on natural selection. You don't want to get these people to a hospital too fast. They're liable to survive. And then what will we do? So make sure that they have, because they're reproducing too fast, get the birth control out there immediately. But also, like, don't be in such a huge hurry to get them to a hospital when they need it. Make that process difficult. Make there fewer hospitals and less doctors and more people in the waiting room and poor quality. Now take a look at that and think of the quality of treatment you get at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Beverly Hills as opposed to what you get in Watts, South Central Los Angeles. I'm bleeding gunshot victims, you know, all the time. Guys come in like, I've just been shot. They're like, oh, have a seat, fill out this paperwork. No, I'm dying. Yeah, great. Have a seat with all the other people that are dying over there. We'll get to you when we can. Again, this idea is still in play. Nothing's changed, really. Here's an interesting component of this, and I've been on this a lot lately with regard to the term transhumanism, that is a rebranding of eugenics. It's, you know, I think enough people understand that eugenics has sort of a bad name to it, you know, because it's murder, right? So again, what if we named it something else that was less murdery and more, you know, scientific-y? And so they came up with a term called transhumanism. You've heard that term before. Julian Huxley invented that term. You know, Julian Huxley, who used to be the president of the British Eugenics Society, you know, so not just some dipshit that had an interest in this, but the guy that was running it, he developed the term transhumanism. So when I say that transhumanism is a rebranding of eugenics, I'm not speculating, and it's not me that's even saying it. I'm just telling you that's what it is. That's what it is. So when you hear the guys at Davos talk about, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, the goal of it is transhumanism, and it's on their website. Once again, I'm not making that up. It's on their website. Just the goal of the World Economic Forum is eugenics. What is eugenics? Depopulation. That's what it is. This is A plus B equals C. It's just very easy to figure this out. So, And Julian Huxley, when he came up with this concept of transhumanism and the terminology, he argued that humans should better themselves through a combination of science, technology, and eugenics. He said that in 1957, right? And he was the guy that was sort of bridging the old eugenics with the new eugenics, and the new being molecular biology. That's really kind of where he was going. He wasn't into nanotech at that time because it didn't exist, but that's the new version of transhumanism 2.0. We're getting out of just the molecular biology world, and we're moving of the late, 57s when he said that. So we're, you know, the first 50 years of transhumanism was molecular biology and, you know, gene editing and, you know, whatever. Now we're moving into nanotechnology and genome research and mRNA technology and all that stuff that's really, really scary. If you heard my episode a couple months ago on Clade X, I mentioned during that he, Julian Huxley, coined the term clade. Probably no surprise why they put the X on the back of it with the X club, but that's speculation on my part. But clade means a single species and its descendant. And you know, so again, they're obsessed with their descendants and whatnot. He also invented the term ethnic group. So when you hear ethnic group being used instead of the word race, then you will know that is the work of the Huxleys, because they are interested in rebranding a little bit. You know, they're writers, so they understood the power of words. And Julian Huxley was, I think, one of the most dangerous guys, right? So he's on the hook for transhumanism. He wrote books with H.G. Wells. He worked on evolution. He worked in genetics. He worked in anthropology. He was measuring skulls. He was talking about, you know, don't get the poor access to the hospitals and things like that. I mean, this is a bad guy. He's a bad guy, you know. And of course, he gets knighted, because that's what you do. You knight the bad guys. I think if there's one thing that you can just kind of, like, you know, take to the bank, and just anybody who is Sir whatever, what's his fuck, is a bad guy. Just if you've been knighted by the British Empire, you're on the wrong team. You're not on Team Humanity. Because all these guys that are involved in that, they all have very close ties to the royal family, Royal Institute, all of these groups, their professors there. It's It's a big circle jerk. They're all on the same team. All right, let's move on to his brother, Aldous Huxley, the most well-known, you know, and least psychopathic. Not because he didn't have that ideology, but he was like a sick kid. He was blind for a couple years. You know, he had some issues, right? So he was never allowed to get into the military because of that. So he didn't, you know, he was a sick kid, right? He spent the first half of his life in London. He spent the last half of his life in Los Angeles. And that's where he sort of got into Hollywood. He was doing a lot of writing there in Hollywood and a lot of influencing. And I think people know him. People obviously know him from Brave New World, which he wrote. And you might recognize he wrote essays. He wrote an essay called Doors of Perception. And then that essay of Doors of Perception was used as the inspiration for the Doors band, rock band. So they took that name from that title, The Doors of Perception. So he taught French for a year, and he had a student in his French class named Eric Blair. Do you know who Eric Blair is? Any guesses? Any guesses at all who Eric Blair is? I think some of you probably know this. Oh, yeah. He goes by a different name when he's writing, George Orwell. One of his students, right? So both of the brothers, Aldous and Julian Huxley, were members of the Committee of 300, which I have said before, I've done an episode on it, the most dangerous group in the world. I think the Committee of 300 is the octopus, so to speak. You know, I mean, maybe not just, you know, maybe not every single, maybe don't have every single guy in there, but if you're a member of the Committee of 300, you are most definitely not looking out for the betterment of humanity. You are looking to form a one world government with that group in control of it. And the Huxleys were members of that, if that gives you any sort of idea. But listen, since I mentioned George Orwell, I'm going to read a letter from Aldous Huxley to George Orwell in 1949. So this would be a year after 1984 came out. 1984 came out in 1948. A lot of numbers, but anyway. Quote, this is from Aldous to Orwell. Within the next generation, I believe that the world's leaders will discover that infant conditioning and narco-hypnosis are more efficient as instruments of government than clubs and prisons, and that the lust for power can be just as completely satisfied by suggesting people into loving their servitude as by flogging them and kicking them into obedience. So what Orwell was about was the boot stomping on your head forever, right? That was his ideology. Overt government control of words, control of movement, control of thought, control of everything, right? But just top down oppressive. What Huxley suggested, he wanted that control too, but his suggestion was it's a lot better when the slaves drug themselves in his book, it was called Soma. It was just like a happiness drug. I don't know, it was like ecstasy or something, right? So these, in his mind, it's just a bunch of people with glow sticks and Mickey Mouse hands at raves, you know, just like, we love our servitude, you know. But and George Orwell was like, no, you need to beat those people into submission. He's like, no, you don't. You do it differently. If you do it differently, it doesn't feel like slavery. You get them to, as he said, you get them to love their servitude. So it's interesting when you look at these two competing strategies for controlling the general public. I feel like after we've gone through 3 years of COVID, you got a little of both. I feel like you got a little of Netflix and chill early on. That was like the Aldous Huxley, like enjoy, you know, you'll come to love your servitude. You'll come to love being on lockdowns. Hell, you'll lock down voluntarily because I get to work from home and I can do it in my pajamas and you know, all those things. as opposed to troops on the street, China, you know, saying welding people into their apartment complex. That's more 1984. America's response to COVID was more Brave New World. So, but again, I think that we might find ourselves in a situation where that flips, or we get both, you know, loving your servitude for the people that watch MSNBC and CNN, and overt welding you into your house for the people that like Fox News that are more defiant. So I don't know. But after writing Brave New World, he got into psychedelics, and it really kind of changed his outlook on things. So he actually turned down being knighted. Aldous Huxley did. His brother was knighted, but he turned it down, and without an explanation. But you know, he was doing a bunch of mescaline at the time, and I think, and I've been pretty vocal about this. I think that people that do psychedelics, it changes them. It puts them in a much better frame of mind. You know, you got to be careful. You have to be respectful. It's not a party drug or anything like that. But if you come at it from a particular vantage point where you're interested to know more about how it's going to affect your mind, and you don't look at it like we're all just here to get fucked up. Instead, it's more like I'm here to understand myself a little bit better and connect with an unseen world out there. It can have magical benefits to people. Psilocybin therapy is really popular. It's starting to get really popular now. I've been talking about it for many years. It's extremely beneficial to a lot of people, especially people with depression. So it might have been the one. I mean, looking back on this, and I'm sort of diagnosing from afar, but maybe, you know, Aldous Huxley came out of a family with a ton of mental illness, and maybe it helped him, because he wound up getting into different things after this, but you know, after his psychedelic trips. He worked with Timothy Leary, who was CIA, on the LSD research, but later wound up breaking away from him. So again, I don't know for certain if he broke away from Timothy Leary because their contract was over and they weren't working on anything. And because again, Timothy Leary was connected to the CIA. I think people are now fully understand that. They didn't know it at the time. They didn't know it for a long time. He was a guru, but Huxley was in that club too. They were doing a lot of work together, but then they broke away. And I don't know. I wonder if he figured it out and didn't want to have anything to do with it, or if he was, you know, if they're all just kind of deep state to their core. Here's an interesting little tidbit. And all of you numerology people out there, you can have some fun with this. Aldous Huxley and C.S. Lewis, you know him? He, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, that guy, also British aristocracy, deep state, and that type of stuff. They both died on the same day. There's nothing really inherently weird about that. I mean, it's kind of statistically hard to do. But Aldous Huxley and C.S. Lewis both died on November 22nd, 1963. Same day that Kennedy died. So talk about like bad timing for the press, you know. You're going to get, nobody's going to notice that you guys died. That's a shame. That's a shame. Those two deep state dickheads. Let's talk about Brave New World though, because that's the book that everybody knows. We'll wrap up with Brave New World because it's so relevant to what we're going through now. It's been a long time since I read it. I went back and just kind of reread a synopsis, and I was like, oh yeah, I remember. It's been a while. But I want you to think of this with what you know about the World Economic Forum, okay? And when they talk about Fourth Industrial Revolution, transhumanism, build back better, you'll own nothing and like it, you'll eat the bugs, we'll live in a smart city, a 15-minute city, you know, all of these things that they want us to be involved in, universal basic income, you know, everything associated with Klaus Schwab. And then knowing what we know about Julian Huxley making up, you know, coining the term transhumanism, and then his brother writing Brave New World as a fiction, right? But again, members of the Committee of 300. So is it really fiction or is it predictive programming? You decide, okay? But they talk about state hatcheries in this book, right? They talk about that they live in this place called the World State. World state, you say? You mean like world government? No, nothing like that. No, we assure you. The World State is in London, and they have state hatcheries. People do not have intercourse to produce babies any longer. That's gone. That doesn't happen. That's been replaced by these state hatcheries where the government decides who gets born. And they're not born to parents. There are no parents. They're born to the state. So the state raises you. You know, this is when you start hearing the state raises you, and then you get these assholes on MSNBC talking about, well, actually, children don't belong to their parents. They belong to all of us here in the community. That's soft communism. Okay. That's like, you know, you're in Marxist ideal territory right there with stuff like that. Like the state controls the kids. This is every globalist dream to have the state control the kids, because then you can control the population, you can control all kinds of things. So they created this world state to be what they describe as a pleasure seeking society. So you're not accomplishing great things. You're just out there doing soma all day long. They're encouraging people to have sex with one another at earlier and younger ages. Children are encouraged to engage in sexual activities at a very young age. And one of the things that you'll know, you might not know it from reading the book, but you'll know it if you have just been around long enough and you understand sort of the psychology of what the sexualization and traumatization of kids does to them for the rest of their lives, is that if you sexualize children at a very young age, one of the components is that it makes them hypersexual. And also it suppresses individuality and it breeds conformity. You can sort of make them do what you want them to do if you break them. So in this world state, in Brave New World, they encourage children to engage in sexual activity at a younger and younger age. Now, extrapolate out from that and look at Drag Queen Story Hour and look at drag shows for children and look at I'm a non-binary octopus gender and I want to talk to my third grade class about I'm going to come out to my third grade. And all this shit that you hear that seems sort of like insane and crazy, this is the type of stuff that Huxley talked about and wrote about in Brave New World, that this is a component of it. And we're starting to see that. The removal of family systems in this Brave New World, communists love that. They want the state to be the family. You don't need, you know, that's why when you get these child armies, child soldiers in places like Africa and Southeast Asia where a warlord goes in there and captures these kids, one of the things they make them do is they make the kids murder their parents so that there's no, you know, they burn the bridge. And also then the state is their parents, you know, from that point on. And so this is an idea that is, again, this is a fictional account, a fictional book written in 1932, I think. And, but is it fictional or is it predictive programming? They go on to talk about predetermined class systems, so based on intelligence. So a caste system, sort of like what they have in India, but more Gattaca, I guess. Happy drug called Soma. They could have named the happy drug Netflix instead. That would have worked. Bread and circuses, television, whatever, you know. Just keep taking the soma, keep taking the drug. Don't worry. Don't worry about all that other stuff. Just keep taking pill. And they talked about there were instances where they just sprayed people down with it, like aerosolized soma. And it was like if people were rising up in any way, they would just spray them down with this stuff, and then they'd just fall back into their happiness. So again, metaverse, I think of the metaverse with this. They just put the goggles on. Oh, having a bad day. Girlfriend dumped you. Now, don't worry about it. Your job sucks. Everybody hates you because put the goggles on. You could be anyone in the metaverse, right? You'd be happy. Just stay plugged in there and then you'll be happy and you'll also be out of our way. They talk about something called death conditioning in the book. And I go immediately to medical assistance in dying being pushed in Canada. 10,000 people take them up on their offer last year. They talk about a society of mass production with Pavlovian conditioning. And I just go, God, if that isn't America right now, I don't know what is. Mass production society, Pavlovian conditioning. You know, I stand with Ukraine. The vaccine is safe and effective. You know, trans rights matter. You know, all this stuff. It's just like the next term that they have to get through your head. I the death of nature in this book was a big component of it. I just can't help but see the overlap between the vision of the future that Harari wants over at you'll have no free will. Free will is dead. You know, he's talking about that. These are the technocrats. This is the ideology behind the Huxley family. It's been infused into Klaus Schwab. It's nothing new, of course, but he's taking Brave New World and making it into a documentary, essentially. This isn't going to be in the science fiction category anymore. It's going to be reality if we allow it to happen. And I see the normalization of this through Hollywood. In this push to make everybody sort of compliant and docile and dependent on somebody else for their happiness and thankful of the state. And, you know, the state's going to take care of your health with COVID. You know, Jacinda Ardern in the New Zealand was saying that, you know, don't get your information from anywhere. Your one source of information should be from the government. If you don't hear it from the government, don't listen to it. You know, this idea, this medical martial law, this medical world government, it feels new to us, but it's not. You know, this book has been out for coming up on 100 years, and it gives me the creeps because I think we're walking into the technocrat's dream of you'll own nothing. And I can't help but think that America is the brave new world. Hey, if you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggression, the website, the octopus of globalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.